I'm still going to depart from the book of Galatians today and deal with the book of Daniel and Revelation. You know the teaching and learning theories that I subscribe to. In the German, it's called field theory. Or in the German, it's called Gestalt, but in being translated, it means you grasp the whole field and you are assaulted with the whole mass of information on a subject again and again until an insight comes. There is a moment where it hits you and grips you, and all of a sudden you can see and organize the whole field because of a unifying principle. For that reason, it looks like sometimes we're repeating. When it's a deliberate teaching technique to cover the same ground again and again, filling in or emphasizing separate details each time, designed to have you come to a gestalt of understanding, so the other voices on this subject, who generally attack it piecemeal with an isolated scripture out of context on which they'll base some total theory, these other voices cannot confuse you. So I start where I left off last Sunday and move the other direction. Revelations 13 and 17. Not 13, 17 verse, but the two chapters, Revelations 13 and 17. 13th chapter. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, John the Revelator speaking, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads, 10 horns. I'm writing, you that are listening. Seven heads, 10 horns. And upon his horns, 10 crowns. And upon his heads, the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard. Its general nature, that of a leopard. Feet, as the feet of a bear. Use a different color here. Am I boring you already?
No,
mouth as the mouth of a lion. I'm not drawing a picture of the beast, I'm annotating. And the dragon gave him his power. Power from the devil, who is the dragon. His power, his seat, and his authority. all of his power, his position or throne, and his authority from the devil. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. Seven heads. One, I'm going to give you a head start. Assyria, or rather, correction, Egypt is the first nation who persecuted God's people, the descendants of Abraham, through the promised line, Isaac and Jacob become Israel. Assyria being the second nation to persecute them. Babylon being the third. The Medo-Persians being the fourth. The Greek being the fifth, the Romans being the sixth, and Antichrist in his fullness being the seventh. One of these, either Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greek, Roman, or Antichrist, are wounded or stricken down to death and will rise again. When you put it in that context, you will find it self-evident how ridiculous. I need your prayers this morning. Some of you may have seen me teeter a couple of times because of the continuing inability to throw off this virus. And I'm a bit wobbly up here today. So I'd appreciate it if you whisper a prayer, because God's never failed me yet. As we get moving in these messages, his strength comes. But how self-evident it is that the head that is wounded is one of these nations. Or more specifically, the head or power source of one of these nations. Thus it becomes ludicrous, as you've heard me say many times, to credit some earthly ruler who happens to recover from an assassination attempt that has resulted from a wound in the head, crediting that person as the reference here in Revelation to the wounded head. It's obviously the head of this beast that is wounded. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast. So one of these heads is wounded and comes alive again, or appears slain because it's removed from participation on the face of living earth, and suddenly reappears with new life. As you've heard me again say many times, but there are new people listening who've not been a part of past teachings on this subject, each of these evil heads represent an earthly kingdom, a beastly kingdom, that is positioned against God's promised people. God determined that through the seed of the woman would come redemption and deliverance for mankind. And that seed of the woman would bruise the head of the serpent, Satan. Satan immediately then set out to oppose God's accomplishment of that redemptive plan. His first attempt was to provide a substitute. His last attempt will be to provide a substitute, to deflect from God's genuine Redeemer to Satan's imitation. And the word Antichrist, though it has taken on and ultimately will fulfill the meaning of being against Christ, the root meaning of the word is substitute deliverer, an alternative deliverer. Now, Satan set out to defeat God's plan, knowing all about it, being present in the councils of heaven when the fail-safe plan of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world was revealed. And he led Nimrod, the first rebel, in the very area of Iraq today, Nimrod, whose name means rebel, built Babylon. He married Semiramis, and the false demon, dragon-inspired doctrine was conceived that Nimrod was but a divine incarnation in flesh of the sun, which was worshipped as God. And that when he died, he merely transitioned back to his original position as the heavenly orb of fire, the sun. And his wife Semiramis, becoming pregnant after his death, projected the Babylonian doctrine that is spread into every religion of the world, that the son that was conceived in her and ultimately born and named Tammuz was conceived by a sunbeam from Nimrod returning to his divine state. And thus Tammuz, her son, was a reincarnation in the flesh of the divine son, S-U-N, and thus was the Son of God incarnate in the flesh, I repeat, conceived by a sunbeam. And in Tammuz we find Satan's imitation plan for the seed of the woman to be worshipped and offered as the substitute deliverer. Now you find the Old Testament, the constant problem outside the tabernacle at Shiloh, women weeping for Tammuz, and out of Babylon flows the false religions that produce so many of the traditions we find even in the Christian church. For it is the rebirth of the Son, centered around the worship of Tammuz, that is commemorated on December 25th as the sun in the heavens begins its march back to springtime and life in the summer. We well know Christ was born in the fall on the Feast of the Trumpets, most likely, not in midwinter, but via the mystery religions. The religion of Babylon had flowed into Rome, and the Saturnalia, the birth time of Saturn, who's but another name and another mythological ingraftation of Tammuz. It's the birth of this ancient Babylonian substitute by Satan. And he has pretty much affected the entire religious world with the encroachments into Christian religion, Catholic, Christian, Orthodox Christian, Protestant Christian, Even the Jews, after their stay in Babylon in bondage, made the same accommodations to these Babylonian traditions that was Satan's substitute. His seedbed has always been this area where Nimrod first rebelled against God. To jump ahead, during the tribulation in the last days, it is revealed in the book of Revelation, 200 million demons will be turned loose that have been chained in the area of the prince of the power of the air in this area of Iraq. The very air personifies the demon forces of hell and increases the marvel of what I believe to be God's protection of the pilots that have flown through that territory, ruled so long by the prince of the power of the air, and in the last 48 hours, not one plane lost, and two of our planes in a dogfight with four of the Iraqi MiG-23s shot all four of them down without a loss to America. Now, from this evil source, God brought forth a man of faith that had been trained by both Noah and Shem, Abram. And he led him out of Babylon to a place now known as Nablus, biblically named Bethel, between the two mountains called the Mounts of Blessing and Cursing, dating from an event in Joshua's day, appeared to him and said, "Lift up thine eyes as far as you can see, and north, south, east, and west, and arise and walk, and wherever your feet touch, that is the land I will give to you and to your descendants." In the book of Deuteronomy, God says that he will measure out the lands according to these descendants of Abraham that's led into this place. Wherever he's going to put them, all other things in geography relate. Having called Abram out and having failed to completely bring the world around to the worship of Nimrod, reincarnated as Tammuz, and the queen of the heavens, namely Semiramis, the mother of Tammuz that we see reappearing across the mythological world in Aphrodite, in Venus, in all of the various mother images that dominate so much of mythology and have crept into Christianity as a co-equal part of the Godhead. Having failed with his subterfuge, he then began to oppose this escape from Satan's substitute by Abraham called out, and the promised responsibility and blessing to his descendants, his seed, through whom the Redeemer would come, and by whom God, through focusing in their lives as the oracle source of revelation, through whom God would reveal his plan, in order that we might not be blind in the midst of the struggle. Satan's tactics then became a beastly tactic to destroy Abraham and his seed. I'm sure you have trouble listening on the news trying to figure out the unrelenting and unreasonable hatred exhibited by the peoples in these areas to the United States, to Israel, and to Britain. Not if you consider the source. It's been an unrelenting battle from the moment that God calls them forth. Satan began to assemble his beastly kingdoms. And these kingdoms were ruled not by human beings in the ultimate sense, but rather by human beings under the control of powerful, supernatural, demonic forces. And those powerful, supernatural, demonic forces represent the princes of Egypt, the princes of Assyria, the princes of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and ultimately Antichrist. We're talking about demon possession. In the Old Testament, there is a series of prophecies against Tyre in Lebanon. You are not very far into the reading of the prophecy before you suddenly understand that the prophet is seeing through the human king of Tyre, and even though he continues to refer to him as the king of Tyre, it's obvious that the subject has changed. Because this king of Tyre is described as having his pipes and tabrets created in him from his beginning. This king of Tyre is described as being the crowning cherub on the mountain of God. Well, you could say, well, that's poetic. The rest isn't. This king of Tyre is suddenly described as being in Eden before the fall, of being a favorite of God's, but becoming so proud and lifted up in the position of his beauty and leadership that he decides that he can rise and be like God himself. And then he's cast down. And you haven't read far into the chapters in Ezekiel and Isaiah that describe this king of Tyre, particularly Ezekiel, until you recognize that the prophet has ceased to talk about the front man, the present earthly king of Tyre, but rather is talking about the dragon, Satan, that really possesses and rules the king of Tyre. Likewise, as the prophecies unfold against these enemies of God's people that are the oracle people, those that God has chosen to become the custodian of his word, including becoming the custodian through incarnation, through Mary, out of the line of David, from the line of Pharaohs. They are literally the custodian of the incarnate Son of God, seed of the woman, who will ultimately stamp the serpent. These people must be destroyed by the beast for him to prevent God's redemptive program to unfold. And his instruments are possession of these earthly, beastly kingdoms that will oppress, hate, attack, try to destroy the chosen people. Abram, the birthright people, the sons of Joseph, the king and lawmaking recipient of blessing that will keep the scepter and produce the King of Kings, Judah. And when you put it in that context, Saddam Hussein, the great sodomizer, along with the media who try to sodomize us with him every single night, finally, to Antichrist, you have the heart of the battleground, which will include Syria, southern Turkey, western Iran, Transjordan. The heartland area, which represents the old Seleucid kingdom, to get ahead of my story of Alexander the Great's dispersal of his kingdom, being Syria and Iraq. The heart of it, including both the old ancient Assyrian kingdom and the Babylonian kingdom, and ultimately the heart of the Medo-Persian when they conquer Babylon, and the heart of the Grecian kingdom and the Roman Empire as it extended itself eastward, seating in Constantinople in northern Turkey, Iraq being certainly in the heart of it. Saddam is but in a long chain of that Satan-dominated prince of the power of the air, demon henchman, ruled territory. Now, some of you may be sensitive and quickly say, are you saying that everyone in that area, because we saw Christians worshiping in a church, everyone in that area, demon-possessed, devil-led? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Any more than all of those that were in Egypt were as evil as Pharaoh, because some of them, out of Egypt in the mixed multitude, opted to go with God's people. And even though the mixed multitude, because of its lack of roots, would give trouble in later days, there are plenty of them that were valuable additives, and because of their acceptance of God and His plan, became functioning parts of the delivered people. The Tai, one of the bravest and most valuable bodyguards of David, who was the type of Christ, was a Philistine. But he made his individual choice right. And I saw on the news early this morning, a Christian church in Iraq, and the sermon was out of the book of Jonah, when Nineveh, the Assyrian kingdom, was doomed. And because they prayed, God gave them mercy, much to the irritation of Jonah. God gave them mercy and delivered them. Ultimately, Nineveh was to be destroyed. Ultimately, and throughout, Nineveh was under the control of Satan. But for a break in the chain, the power of God was such that when they prayed and repented, God gave His mercy, and there was a lull in Satan's control over that kingdom. But His power in this area and in His ultimate plan is such, Christianity in that area has tougher sledding than any area of the world. And because the area is as it is and must be painted with this broad brush in God's prophetic plan, doesn't mean every individual is possessed of that evil. Just means every individual's got to work a little harder of coming out from under driving under its influence. Their curative process probably fits into the category of Jesus' statement, these kinds come forth with much prayer and fasting. Deliverance comes hard in that area. And any missionary, and I worked as a consultant to missionaries for more than 18 years, any missionary will tell you it's one of the most difficult areas of the world to minister the Christian message. And paradoxically, those who have paid the price to make their commitment to Christ in those areas are among the most vital and genuine and powerful and unshakable Christians you'll find anywhere in the world because of the price tag attached to being a Christian and what it costs you in that area. But these beastly kingdoms represent the foci of Satan's master plan to destroy God's program of redemption. And in this revelatory picture, one of these heads, namely these earthly beastly kingdoms, whose real heads are the princes of evil, lieutenants under Satan that rule therein, one of them was wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast, which means that this wounded head, which requires the understanding, the prince that rules this head is wounded and then comes alive again, and coming alive, he is the beast. So, inductively, we move back and know that whatever one of these heads, the prince of power, a demon that ruled it, is wounded and will not reappear again, resurrected until it possesses Antichrist, the wounded one, possesses Antichrist. And the one that possesses Antichrist, inversely, is the one that used to be the head of one of these other kingdoms and has been wounded. And they worship the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. So Antichrist will be possessed by a demon, to say it simply, which said demon possessed one of these previous 6 beastly kingdoms. And that demon will come forth and possess Antichrist and rule for 42 months. Which other passages, there's no prophecy of Scriptures of private interpretation, we know to be the last 42 months before Armageddon, during that period known as the tribulation, the great tribulation, to be distinguished from all other tribulations on earth, because it is tribulation brought from heaven by God on this earth, proceeding through 6 seals or 7 seals that are opened, 7 trumpets that are blown, and 7 vials that are poured out. Therefore, we know this Antichrist, under the possession of the demon who used to possess one of these previous kingdoms, will possess the last world ruler and give him power and authority and seat for 42 months, 3.5 years, which is the second half of Daniel's 70th week, the time of great tribulation. We ain't there yet. Sorry to those that have got some books already going to press saying Saddam is the Antichrist. We ain't there yet. He either came to power too quick and muffed his chance if he wants to be Antichrist, or he ain't the one. Because there are things that have to happen before Antichrist takes this full orb power, and he's premature. He pulled his power chain too quickly. He started the motor prematurely. He should have said, it's being possessed by Satan or Kuwait. And that would have made it easy. The bunker hunker sitting down there in his little hole, knowing that he's going to get whipped, could have said to himself, I want to be him, and I don't have my full power yet. So, goodbye, Quate. But being a prototype of the man that will be susceptible to this demon force, he pulled the trigger and is giving us a little foreshadowing of the way it will be and how easy God can just move things on this earth and make it fit his pattern, because his pattern will be an alignment. Now, let me see if I can go over this mess and make it look worse. Here's Europe, Mediterranean, Africa, Middle East, Persian Gulf, Russia, see, and China. Isn't that all clear? And the final balance of power alignment on this earth will be an Antichrist in this Iraqi area, Syrian area, that will unite 10 in the area, uproot 3, create so much disturbance that a confederacy will be formed and he will be granted the chairmanship, and there will be an alignment of Western nations that are watching nervously, Israel in the middle, a bone of contention, a confederacy ruled by Antichrist, a northern confederacy that is positioned contrary to the Western confederacy, which will include Germany, Turkey, Ethiopia, Libya, Tagama of the northern parts, which is Turkey, Gomer and all his bands, which is Germany, Ethiopia, Libya. And this northern confederacy at some point will be stirred up and move southward over Israel. We know that this Antichrist, after he comes to power, will still be disturbed by Egypt, the king of the south. We'll get into, as Daniel 11 has it, an area conflict with Egypt. And while he is in the process of fighting with Egypt, will be disturbed with news out of the north and the east. And in the latter part of Revelation, in the latter part of that 42 months, sixth angel will pour out his vial, and the reason it's poured out is to dry up the river Euphrates, that the way might be provided for the kings of the east, and everything will gather right here at the plain of Megiddo. We're quite a ways from that. But what we are seeing is the impermanence of any kind of Western alliance with Russia. What you are seeing is the so-called peaceful turn toward the west of Russia clamping down quickly. What you are seeing most likely is a merciful opening of the door to give the individuals in that doomed area, to give the individuals in that doomed area a last chance to hear the gospel. But you will see that curtain close again, if not immediately, ultimately, because Satan's control over this Iraqi area dates back to Nimrod. And what we really have is a warfare in the heavens where we're just the foot soldiers, as Satan, Michael and his angels are going at it and have been going at it down through the centuries. There will come a time in this book of Revelation where Michael is turned loose and the boundaries that have constricted him will be removed. We get a glimpse in the book of Jude and other spots of Michael's restrictions. When Moses died, Michael and Satan wrestled over the body of Moses. Because Satan knew how important Moses was to God's plan, because Satan knew that Moses would come and play the role that he's going to play in the last days. I mean, there will be two witnesses in the last days that appear on the streets of Jerusalem. They work mighty miracles as the world looks on, which never could have happened until TV came along and CNN is practicing. I mean, that's the good with the bad. We are seeing CNN practice what the Bible told us centuries ago would happen on the streets of Jerusalem. As God would send two final witnesses during the tribulation after the church is gone. And they would perform mighty miracles, which are identical miracles to those that Elijah and Moses performed. Now, all Bible scholars have speculated about who are those two witnesses. They go to Enoch, that the record suggests was not, for God took him. And he didn't die, or at least we have no record of his death. And then we have Moses, whose death is shrouded in mystery, and an enigmatic New Testament reference says Satan and Michael, the archangel, wrestled over his body. And to stay on the train of thought I was on, that Michael had restrictions, that enigmatic record says Michael dared not curse Satan to his face, but had to fight with him under not Geneva Convention rules, but some ultimate rule of contest. But Michael prevailed and took the body of Moses to hide it away. Elijah. We have Elisha's record that he went up in a fiery chariot. So these three are often suggested as the witnesses, as the choices from which the two last witnesses that come down from heaven and witness with mighty miracles on the streets of Jerusalem in the last days of tribulation to prove God's eternal mercy, to forever be giving a chance of grace and to respond to the gospel message. I lean toward Elijah and Moses. I think Enoch had his day building the pyramid. Elijah and Moses, we have the record of their difficult training in faith. We have the record that the miracles they did are almost verbatim repeated in the record of the miracles that would be performed by the last two witnesses. Furthermore, the record says these witnesses will testify of Christ. Now, there are appearances in the New Testament. The appearance on the Mount of Transfiguration has Jesus talk to Moses and Elijah after the disciples went asleep and Peter woke up and saw Elijah and Moses talking to Jesus, and it says they were talking of his decease to come. There were two shining witnesses witnessing and recorded by those who saw the empty tomb, witnessing of the resurrection. And when Christ ascended, two shining witnesses. It's speculation that the same two that are named on the Mount of Transfiguration are the same witnesses of his resurrection and his ascension. But whether true or not, as those witnesses, the point is, Michael, having finished that parenthesis side road for the curious, Michael, when he wrestled over the body of Moses, which I believe God preserved and kept because Moses appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration and will come again to finish his witness in the land that God called him forth to. The point is, Michael was limited in the use of weaponry against Satan. In the book of Revelation, the time will come when God says to Michael, now
the limitations are lifted. And he seizes Satan, casts him out of the heavenlies till he has no more access, as he did in the book of Job, to the councils of heaven. And he's limited just for a short time to the earth alone. And that's what causes his wrath to pour out on the earth, because he knows his time is short and he's limited just to the earth and all the denizens of the heavens. Sing and shout hallelujah and glory, because Satan has been driven from access in the heavenlies and is limited to this earth. And that's when the real terrible power of evil is unleashed on the earth, at the same time that the beast that has been stricken will possess Antichrist. Now go to the 17th chapter. The same beast. He carried me away into the wilderness, the third verse of the 17th chapter. He carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman, which I'll not talk about, the false church, sit upon a scarlet-covered beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Same beast again. Then the angel says in the 7th chapter, wherefore didst thou marvel? Because John could not conceive of a false church being in the first century. He was astonished to see into the future a church riding upon this beast, cavorting with it. And the angel says, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman, and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is. I preach about 5 sermons on this chapter, including the call and election of God. Many times I've said it's not your choice to encounter the light that shines. Some are called and some aren't. And those that have found in themselves the gift of responsiveness to God's word can thank God that you have that gift in you, because your names were written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, before you were ever conceived. Now, here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. And the woman is that false religion that worships Tammuz and Semiramis, that has fed itself Ishtar, Ashtoreth, on through every single religion, that worship of the woman, that substitute religion has intruded itself into even the Church of Jesus Christ, has said, and that woman's always been there riding on this beast. The 7 heads are 7 mountains, and there are 7 kings. Now we come to the personified rulers of these beastly kingdoms. 5 are fallen. Well, now John is speaking at the time of the Roman Empire. Correct? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are fallen. You want that slow? It's pretty obvious. Assyria, Egypt, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. We're talking about the beast. 7 kings. 5 are fallen. 1 is. The one that is as John is prophesying, is Rome. The other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth. Now, we have another projection out here, which lets the change of the wounded one actually be on Antichrist, but produce through possession a new kind of ruler, which is the demon that divides the Antichrist kingdom into his human portion, the seventh, and is possessed by demon's portion, which is the eighth. Five are fallen. One is Rome. The other is not yet come. And when he cometh, Antichrist in his earthly reign, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. So the beast that was and is not is the head that was wounded and will rise again. And he will possess, as I got ahead of the story, he will possess the seventh kingdom, which is Antichrist in earthly rulership, and having possessed him, will make him become something different, namely a demon-possessed, miracle-working, powerful ruler possessed of Satan. That then will fuse into the eighth and final kingdom, which is Antichrist. This demon does not come out of some new territory of demon forces. Rather, it is specific that the demon that comes and possesses Antichrist and makes him become the kind of ruler called the eighth kingdom is a demon who was of the seven, and was and is not in John's day, so it's obviously not the prince that ruled Rome. So since he is one of the seven, it has to be the prince that ruled one of these six. Your choice then is narrowed down by last Sunday's message, where we see in Daniel 11 that the king of the north and the king of the south that are in constant battle in Daniel 11 represent the Seleucid general who received in the breakup of Alexander the Great's kingdom that portion of the kingdom from Babylon to Lebanon on the coast and Syria. The king of the south is the Ptolemaic general and thus the ruler of Egypt. And Daniel 11 is provided in God's book precisely to pull our identification of Antichrist from the full broad Roman Empire to that portion of the Roman Empire that embraces the continuing fight between the Seleucid king in Babylon and the king of Egypt, the Ptolemies. Having identified the king of the north, it then is made clear in Daniel 11 that Antichrist is none other than one who rules in the place of the Seleucid general. In other words, he rules in Babylon or Syria or Transjordan, highly unlikely. Southern Turkey, highly unlikely, because Togarma will be with the Russian group, which tends to eliminate it. And Iran, highly unlikely, because most of it was outside the Seleucid kingdom. Therefore, we know that the earthly rulership period of Antichrist will be a ruler in the area where Iraq is now the heart. And that earthly ruler at some point will be possessed of a demon that possessed one of these six, who will come forth out of the bottomless pit and take him into superhuman qualities, miracle-working qualities. And this beast of the seven kings, verse 10, Revelation 17, five are fallen, one is, and the other's not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. That's Antichrist earthly. And the beast that was somewhere possessing one of those six and is not, thus not the beast that ruled Rome, and when he cometh, the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. Go back to the 13th. The beast was like a leopard. That means his nature, in general, will be that of Greece. Because leopard was the symbol for the Grecian kingdom. His feet will be where the bear's feet were planted. The Medo-Persian Empire, which includes Iraq and Iran. And his mouth, the message that he proclaims, the basis of his speech-making, will be that of the lion, will be the message that comes out of Babylon, which will be the message of Nimrod and that evil religion that was based in Babylon and the rebellious spirit that the first rebel characterized as he turned against God to set up a kingdom here on this earth. All that symbolism tells you this Antichrist will come out of exactly the area where Saddam rules, with the expansion and the possibility, where I've leaned for many years, to his power vacuum, if this war destroys him, being filled with greater strength by Syria. It will be in the area of Iraq, Syria, Transjordan, I've said unlikely. Southern Turkey, probably not, because it's part of the Russian Confederacy in the last days. Western Iran, meaning there might be a new vacuum that centralizes in those two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris. The demon most likely to possess him is therefore the demon that possessed and ruled the Grecian kingdom. Because we have a clue in the Old Testament when the angel came to deliver the message to Daniel. Gabriel said to him, "The angel of God, I heard your prayer 3 weeks earlier, and I was prevented from bringing the message for 3 weeks by the princes of Persia." These powerful demon forces that ruled this 1, 2, 3, 4th kingdom. We know that these princes of Persia are not earthly rulers. They couldn't withstand Gabriel. When he appeared, Daniel fell to his face. You only have to read the descriptions in Daniel 9 and 10 to know no earthly prince could hold him up. You get your second clue when Gabriel refers to Michael coming to help him against these princes and calls Michael the prince of princes. So you know the subject matter of princehood is angelic beings. And he's only able to break through when Michael, the prince of princes, who in another passage wrestled against Satan, constricted, but winning to get the body of Moses, and who in the end will cast Satan out of the heavens when he's turned loose free to do it. This Michael comes to help Gabriel, and with Michael's help against these princes of Persia, Gabriel can get through. Gabriel goes on to say, as it moves from the 10th to the 11th chapter in Daniel, "I will return now that I've delivered the message. And when Gabriel, when Michael and I finish, lo, the prince of Persia is no more. Lo, the prince of Grecia comes." And we have the record in the earlier passages of the goat and the ram that Persia had unlimited power, then all of a sudden it has no power, and the goat, the symbol of Greece, comes with a power that just sweeps unimpeded across the area. The clue is that Michael and Gabriel ended the hold of the princes of Persia, and into that vacuum came the powerful demon that possessed Alexander the Great and enabled him to conquer the world and that area so young. And you who have studied the life of Alexander the Great know the sequence of his consulting with oracles and demon powers in Egypt before he carried forth his final conquering thrust. And no doubt you found the clue of the motivation that made him move his capital and settle at Babylon in his final days. When he dies, and the scripture says in Daniel, broken off in his prime, it says the four who stand up in his place, the four generals, including the two, the Seleucid general and the Ptolemaic general, the king of the north and the king of the south, they stand up in his place, but not in his power or his dominion. Because that prince, demon, that possessed Alexander the Great was gone for whatever reason, and his generals did not have that demon power possession, which is why they continued to generate through the decades, or degenerate through the decades in power, and you study their battles, and unlike the superhuman sweep of Alexander the Great, they're merely human generals marshaling their power against each other. In most cases, it is my view, it is the Bible view, that it is one of the princes of these six that will come out of the bottomless pit and possess Antichrist, thus fusing it into the eighth kingdom, which is demonic in its possession and power. It is my view that it is the same exact demon put in the bottomless pit, just as Satan will be put there 1,000 years and then released at the end of the millennium. It is that demon that possessed Alexander the Great, which is the beast that was stricken and will come out of the bottomless pit to reappear and possess the last earthly ruler, Antichrist, and will make him superhuman, and he will then go to perdition. And that's why it is the leopard, the Greek, still ruling with its feet in the area of the bear, the territorial constriction, and the mouth of the Babylonian message. Now, in the last days, no matter how much peace moves by Russia, Ezekiel 38 and 39 show they will be against God and against God's people in the last days. And furthermore, even at the end of the millennium, after Armageddon produces so many dead of the Russian Confederacy in Palestine that there's a graveyard memorial to them, at the end of the millennium, Satan, released for a season from the bottomless pit, will still find a seedbed of anti-God feeling and will be able to assemble an army in the area of Russia, bring them down, encompass Jerusalem even after the millennium. And in that occasion, they will be destroyed with atomic-type activity. Fire from heaven will destroy them. So the world will take this shape. Russia and its confederacy from the north, the drying up of the river Euphrates to make way for the kings of the east, Antichrist in an area fight with Egypt, troubled by the news, plains of Megiddo where Christ will come and exercise his final judgment, and the nations of the west always lined up defensively, protecting this territory that God once preserved, and the nations of Judah, Israel, and the house of Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, and the so-called lost tribes, the Celtic peoples, will find themselves unavoidably joined with Israel against this pressure from the north, a late developing pressure from the east, and fighting against Antichrist to the end. I'm sorry, Saddam is a prototype. You see in him how easily God can focus the world on the area. You read the traits of the king of the north in the last verses of Daniel 11. You'll find his personality conforms, but he's too soon on the scene. He's not the Antichrist, and he's going to be whipped. He's going to get his ass kicked. This is truly a holy war. But the Holy One of eternity is on this side. And I'm sorry, the record of history shows God's word's been right every time. And our boys, men, and women over there can take comfort in the fact that they are an instrument of the God of eternity, who knows exactly what's going on, controls the future, and is bigger than Saddam. He's even bigger than the sodomizers, the media. And they'll still be around reporting when the church is gone, reporting on the two witnesses and wondering where they get their power. And they'll be thanking God, come Armageddon, that they're constricted to a pool and not on the front lines when the sword starts going from the mouth of Jesus. God's in control is the essence of this message. And look up, our redemption draweth nigh. And don't be terrorized. This one's not the last one, which means because Britain and the United States and Israel still have a part to play on God's side in the last days, they'll still be around and on top of things when the sodomizers have been sodomized. I'll see you this afternoon. Come on, ushers.